Today we are going to have a different form of sermon, so we will share with other members here. So Gina and John and Brooke will bring part of this sermon. So they are not introduction to the sermon. They are part of this sermon. Today we are bringing our story of Thanksgiving together to form a new reality and a new hope as individual and as a church. So whoever ready is Gina here?
If you knew me growing up, you might have described me as quiet and extremely shy. In fact, I was so timid, I used to make my sister, who is 4 years younger than I, go to the counter at McDonald's to ask for ketchup because I couldn't do it. My teachers would often ask my parents at conference time if I ever spoke at home because I rarely raised my hand in class. In public speaking, I would turn beet red, and my nerves would often hinder my speech. I wouldn't have been able to do something like this today. So you can imagine how I felt when Pastor Medhat called me and asked me to speak today. My initial thought was to run screaming, saying, "I just had a baby." But after talking with him, I thought, I can do this. So I'm speaking today about God in moments of my life. Throughout my childhood and into adulthood, God was in those shy moments, and I felt him gently coaxing me and guiding me to a different life than one that I had ever imagined. And God has been in every moment that has shaped my life into what it is today. He brought me to this church, and he pushed me to serve. He challenged me to become even a leader, even though I continue to struggle with that to this day. And he's given me this opportunity to speak to all of you. And through it all, I have felt God's presence through the loving encouragement of all the people I have met along the way who have been with me and walked with me through this journey. And I continue to sense God in every moment, the blessed ones and the challenging ones, and am comforted to know that he is with me all the way. Thanks.
John?
When I first started coming to PPC, I was felt kind of like a man adrift in space. I didn't know anybody in Rhode Island. I didn't have any sense of purpose in my city, and I had no sense of community in my neighborhood. And most distressing to me was I was still struggling to answer a question that I feel like most people have figured out by fourth or fifth grade of what I wanted to be when I grew up. And so that's kind of where I was at when one day during service, somebody, I can't remember who, it was either Sally or Gina probably, tapped on my shoulder and said that there were too many kids for the teacher to be able to handle down in the godly playroom during Sunday school, and would I mind going down and providing crowd control or something along those lines, which I'm pretty sure the only reason I was asked was because I was sitting the closest to that door at the time. So I went down and helped out, and the kids are all really well behaved, so it was an uneventful lesson, but at the end of it, Gina handed me the lesson plan for the next Sunday school and said that the teacher needed an assistant. The usual assistant was out of town or something. Would I mind getting some crafts together, or just reading the lesson plan and kind of being prepared? So I did that, and when I got to the class that Sunday, it turned out that something had come up, and the teacher had to leave, and I had to teach the lesson. And at that point in my life, I had zero experience working with kids, and zero experience teaching in any context. So it was something that, if I had had a choice in the matter, I would have politely said, "No, thank you," and left the room and come back up here. But luckily for me, I didn't really have a choice, and so I had to get up there in front of a bunch of kids that I didn't know and that didn't know me, and teach them a lesson about David and Goliath, and appropriately enough, about overcoming fear and doing what needs to be done. And the lesson went surprisingly well. I'm not really an outgoing or openly enthusiastic person, and I had assumed that I would need to be in order to kind of engage kids and get them excited about a lesson, but it turns out that with kids, enthusiasm and excitement are kind of their default modes, and when you teach them, it's not about getting them excited, it's about taking the excitement that's already there and channeling it and focusing it towards a specific lesson or activity, and it turned out that I was kind of good at that. So after that lesson and a few more lessons, I kind of inadvertently became the PPC's go-to childcare guy. So I went from having never worked with kids to working with them multiple times a week, and I know it's a cliche, but I really do feel like that I've been learning so much more from the kids than they've been learning from me, especially now I'm doing childcare for the English Learner Fellowship, and that's the added challenge of a language barrier between the kids and myself. And over the past few months, I've kind of been building up a sense of trust and friendship between us through mostly nonverbal communication. So that's been fun. And I've also recently started taking the first tentative steps towards pursuing a career in either primary education or professional childcare. So I just wanted to thank Pastor Chris and Gina and Sally and everyone else at PPC for helping me start down a path that I never would have stumbled onto by myself. So I'm thankful for that.
Like Gina, I'm very nervous in front of groups, but unlike her, I didn't have the good sense to really prepare my thoughts, so bear with me for a second here. I may have misunderstood what you were asking for, Matt Hat. I have a little trouble understanding you sometimes on the phone, but I kind of thought that what Matt Hat had asked me to talk about was God bringing us places, being with us as we go to places without being sure of where we're going or something along those lines. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I find the whole thing about, and I'm sure a lot of you do too, the whole thing about when we make decisions, or what if we had made other decisions in our lives, and where would we be if we had made them, and where would others be? You know, you think back on some of the big decisions, like where you go to college, if you went to college, who you marry, where you live, what kind of jobs you have, and you can think about how different your life might have been, and how different lives of others might have been. And then if you start thinking about how everybody's decisions all together and how different the world could be if, you know, we'd all made different decisions, and it becomes a little daunting. It's sort of frightening, really, in a way, sort of like standing on a cliff and looking out into the vast beyond or something. And if you add to that, for me, when I was younger, I guess I sort of had an idea that was, I think, prevalent in among some Christians, that God has something in particular in mind for us, and it's sort of our job to figure out what that is, or not figure it out, but to listen for God's direction and then follow that path. And so I think I very often have had anxiety about the decisions that I make, and worried, and so it becomes a lot easier for me to just let things unfold and not make the decision, just let it happen. And that was been true in a lot of areas in my life, and I'm going to talk in particular about one of those, particularly education and career. I was a philosophy major at LSU as an undergraduate. I blitzed through in 6 years, and you can well imagine that a philosophy degree leads you right into a career, not. And I was distracted, I'll say, somewhat during my undergraduate days, and that left me with a sense of not having really gotten all out of my education that I wanted to get. And so after a couple of years, I went on to a little school that no longer exists, really, called the Presbyterian School of Christian Education. I wanted a chance to do more kind of theological, philosophical type reflection. But not, you know, it was a decision I made. I wasn't 100% sure it was right, but I did it anyway. And then I went from there to Divinity School in New Haven, Yale. And then I was there, and I decided to go to grad school. You know, again, never really sure that this is what I ought to be doing. And I applied to Brown, and I also applied to Yale. I got accepted to Brown. And some of my other friends at the Divinity School were already hearing back from the Yale Graduate School. Either they were accepted or rejected. And I hadn't heard. And for some reason, those of you who know New Haven, there's the Divinity School is kind of up the hill from downtown where the main part of the university is. And I was downtown, and I was near to the Department of Religious Studies, and I decided to wander in there and just see if they could tell me something about where, you know, where the answer was. And so I walked in, I talked to the secretary, and she said to me, she went back and talked to the chair, who was Hans Frey, I think, and she came back out and said, Professor Frey would like to speak with you. Well, I wasn't prepared for like an interview or anything, but I went in, he asked me a few questions, and apparently I was not making a very strong impression, because he then said to me, you better take that, you know, acceptance at Brown. So that's how we got to Brown, and that led us obviously here. And Jill took a job at a lab. This is going somewhere, believe it or not. At a dental lab, and at the dental lab, she met a woman named Linda, and Linda she actually came to this church for a while, married a guy who was a caretaker up at Camp Wilmot, and then left here. And Linda had a daughter named Roxanne from a previous marriage, and Roxy is, for those of you who don't know, is Nathan's birth mom. So all that long journey led to our adopting Nathan, and it was a real blessing. And, and all that time, I wasn't sure, and I could still see some results of my choices that I would say, don't confirm them, probably. But I do know that we got Nathan out of all of that. And there were days when I might want to throttle him. most of the time, it's a real joy.
And I'm going to share my story, part of my story, because I can't share the whole story with you. And to reflect and to honor what the three of you shared with us, and the courage and the vulnerability through sharing the piece of your own story. And I want to reflect on Psalm 126, the one we just read before. And this psalm is very important for me because I had a story I'd like to share with you. I grew up in the southern part of Egypt, where some of the old and ancient tradition are still alive and still part of our recent culture. I know that many Christians around the world would love to see and touch the holy places, especially the Holy Land, Jerusalem. And I can't forget when Chris came here, the joy she was sharing about the experience of being really there, where you can imagine that's where Jesus was and that's where things happen. And it's amazing to be in touch in a visual, to put the scripture versus the visual scene you can see in front of you. I know that's a very important thing. Many people take their journey to the holy sites very seriously, and not just as a vacation or a part of tourist plan. I'm saying that because the story I remembered when I was a teenager, one of my neighbors was an old Christian man who goes by title, and this is a word maybe you can remember from Arabic, Mekaddis, which literally means holy man. I was wondering what that title meant, because I know he wasn't a priest or a monk, he's just a regular guy. why they're giving him this very important, very special title. This man was the only one in my town to be titled Muqaddas or Holy Man. One day I asked him, why is everybody calling you a holy man or Muqaddas? His answer was, because I was lucky enough to go to the Holy Land before 1948. And as a young guy, I didn't know a lot about politics, I didn't know about history, and even as I became older, I don't want to know, because it's tiring and it's depressing sometimes. And he was telling me the borders were still open there and was no trouble traveling from Egypt to Israel. And here's what's more important, to run away from the politics. He sold half of his farm to pay for his trip. And a farm and a land in my tradition is not just something you can buy and sell. It's something you feel shame if you did someday sell part of your inheritance. So a land in our tradition, it's not just for a market. It's something with the fingerprints of your tradition and history. So when you sell it, you actually sell a part of your body. But that was telling me was something more important, even to carry the shame and to accept being critiqued by his own community, because that was something very important for him. He told me, I sold half of my farm to pay for this trip. And also he told me about his last day in the village before he went to Jerusalem. He said, everybody kissed and hugged me like if I'm not going to come back again. Do you know why? Because it was very difficult. Just think about Middle East more than 60 years ago. How was the transportation? How was things very dangerous? And flying is not an option. He already sold half of his just to pay for the transportation. His transportation, he told me, was a donkey in some areas, a train in some areas, a ship, and a camel. And he told me that it was magnificent. It was worthwhile to see and touch where Jesus was born, walked, and crucified. I saw that in his eyes. He really meant it. And surprised me at this day why he took this conversation with a teenager that serious. But that, I think, was more important for him to share a story. To say something close to his heart. Something was buried for many years. And maybe nobody knows about it. Or care to ask even about it. He told me after my trip to the Holy Land, my name changed forever. He said, even people forget my first name. Everybody called him Muqaddas, which means the lucky one who visited the holy sites. And the story brought me closer to the message of this psalm. When the Jews were taken into exile, 500 years before Jesus Christ, the Jews lived in Babylon, which is today Iraq, for almost 70 years. And if you didn't know about exile is the most brutal term you can use when somebody occupying other land. It's a very ancient, hard word of the stronger taking over from the weak. And the exile is somebody will come and invade your country, take the best of your sources, which at these days was your people, and take them away and replace them for another place. So it's not the form of occupation we see today, like you go to one place and you have a powerful military base on the ground and then you're controlling the country. It was made to make people feel bad about themselves. It was very, very brutal system for the Jews. Not only to be far away, but to be somebody they are not looking for. This psalm was very important for the Jews to remember the exile. where their hope to return, and their hope was like a tiny seed. And that's why the psalmist said, we were like a dreamer. They dreamed about the moment when they could return and worship in the house of the Lord. But here is the reality. Where are they now? Now, these people are not in exile anymore. But the psalmist asked them to remember what happened. Don't have a very easy memory where you can erase everything once we arrive at our destination. There is a powerful thing when we remember where we were and where we are now. Remember this, where we are now, it was a dream in the past. Don't take it for granted. Don't just move on. Enjoy the moment of harvest. Now we are home. We need to still remember. We can live better if we can keep the connection between the past and the present. Later, this psalm became the national song of the pilgrimage during their journey to Jerusalem. And the Jews lived for centuries all over the Middle East, not like the modern day. They lived in Egypt, in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, all these until like 60 years ago, and they were fine. And their hope all around the Middle East one day to visit the Holy Land. And they saved a lot of money, but the journey always was difficult and dangerous. The pilgrimage during their journey to Jerusalem, people wanted to go to the temple, not like any place else. It's only one temple for every Jew. The dream is to go to Jerusalem and worship in the real place. These pilgrims spend a lot of money to make this trip, knowing that their lives were always in danger. This psalm was one of the best psalms to comfort and help pilgrims through their journey. They chanted the psalm personally and as a group. And the wonderful thing about this chanting is they were actually walking a dark way. And when we all learn about the Psalm 23, when I walk in a valley of death, this wasn't actually imagination, this was a real place. That's when they were walking in a desert, in a dark place, they call it a valley of death. Because you can see nothing, and your life is really on the edge. So when they were chanting, they were sending a message to say, hey, we are here together. We can see each other, but we can hear each other. So the song itself was bringing the history to be alive. And at the same time, bringing people together. Through the chanting of the psalm, the travelers were saying, we believe in God in the past and in the present. And even if we can't see the future, but we still believe in that too. What surprised me about the psalms, how the psalmist is still asking God to return them from the exile. I think he's asking about the spiritual exile. They're already there, they got their dream, but sometimes we ask for what we can't have, and we can't enjoy what we are really holding in our hands. Their hearts were not fully closed to God, even they were in the house of the Lord.